So do you have anything you would like to say to the recipient of your sperm or a child born from your sperm?
Look both ways before you cross the street, and have fun. Have fun with these genes.
Hi, I'm Kaylee. I'm a child of donor 5182. Welcome to the Message in a Bottle podcast. Hello again. It's been pretty crazy since I released the first episode. I originally had planned on recording one long episode to submit as my philosophy project for school, but I'm having too much fun. So the podcast has kind of taken on a life of its own. A good number of people listened to the first episode, so thank you. Also, I recently found this whole online community of donor-conceived people that I had no idea existed, and I have already had so many great conversations. I'm going to sit down to talk with a bunch of these donor-conceived people to hear their stories for an episode very soon. But back to today. I interviewed my biological father, who shall remain nameless, to talk about all things sperm donation. We spoke over Zoom, and I felt a little awkward at first.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
I'm pretty good.
Oh, this is fun.
I'm running errands all day, so I'm kind of like, eh.
Yeah, it is exhausting. Fun errands or no?
No, just errands, you know, the kind that when they're over, you're really happy that you did them because mm-hmm. you had to do them.
Could you tell me about where you were in your life when you became a donor, like how old you were and where you were in your
I could.
Family? Yeah, you could. If you wanted to.
I was, must have been about 39 or 38. And I was, let's see, Luca, my son, who I actually, you know, knew about, was about two and a half range. And I was walking down the street. I was walking down Mass Ave in Cambridge, and there was a sign that said, Harvard students wanted. And I was like, oh, well, I'm not a Harvard student, but I was once. Mm-hmm. And I read the thing, it was sperm donors. They were looking for sperm donors. And I was like, oh, that's kind of a novel thing. And I saw there was an address that was like right there, and it was sort of blocks away from where my post box was then. I had a business post box. So it was in an area that I would come to every day, not every day, but a couple times a week. And so I thought, well, what the heck? I'll go knock on the door. And they interviewed me and they said, well, you're a little old for this, but we'll test you. And they tested my, you know, my fertility
right.
or whatever it was they were testing for. They said, well, it looks okay. So sure. And, And what I was thinking was like, I'm not going to have any more kids with Luca's mom. I was pretty sure about that because of our age and just because how we were getting along. I had the feeling there was going to be no more, mm-hmm. No more kids produced in the conventional way.
Right.
the old fashioned way.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, he's a good kid, you know, maybe somebody else can maybe I can help somebody out. And so that was pretty much, and I, you know, I did it for like a year, year and a half, kind of, you know, not every week, but a couple times a week I'd drop by there. And then finally, I think I was about to hit 40 and they said, well, we have to retire you. We just don't, you know, we don't have donors over 40, you know? That was the end until a year or two later, they contacted me and they said, we have a client who would like to have another child by the same donor. And I guess I don't know anything about how they handle their inventory, but I guess they try to move it through pretty quick.
Right.
You know, they don't archive it. It's not like a wine collector or something.
Right. Yeah, it's like ancient sperm.
Right, exactly.
It's like a
horror. Sperm from Napoleon. No,
that would be great. But like in theory, I guess that Right? If you freeze it at the right temperature for a long time.
I guess so. If it was like really ultra deep frozen, probably you could. And I, you know, you got to believe that a lot of these billionaire types and, you know, people with too much money on their hands and too big of an ego are probably deep freezing, you know, are probably doing that because they think the world
needs
more of them. So I got the call and I said, they said, well, would you be willing? I said, sure. And I assume that was Aiden.
Then we talked about what he expected would come of his time as a donor originally. And this question of if the type of guys who become sperm donors in the first place are more narcissistic than the average person or not.
Well, I thought that when I was done, I thought that was the end. I thought,
right.
I didn't literally forget that I had done it for however many years that was, 10 years between Aiden donating for Aiden and then finding out about Esther. It was about 10 years, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But in that time, I really just didn't think about it. Once in a while, something would remind me, you know, if there was one of those movies or something, I'd say, oh, yeah, I wonder. but I wasn't like, I got to find these kids. And, I need
to. Or they have to find each. Yeah.
Or they have to find me.
Right.
Or, I was like, you know, I hope it all worked out I had no idea if it was like two people, two kids, or, you know, 20 or whatever, you know.
Right. And they don't tell you. That's part of it. Right.
Right. That's right. It's totally, both sides have to agree to communication.
Mm-hmm.
And they never asked me about it. You know, they never contacted me about anything. And so it was just, I just thought, oh, well, I hope something good came of it.
That's interesting.
Right. It's a little like that. Maybe it's a little like a message in a bottle or something, you mm-hmm. know, where you don't expect that anything's going to ever happen. You know, you're just sort of sending something out into the universe that you think is a positive, you know, positive thing. So when Esther, you know, when that whole thing happened, that was just like mind boggling.
Yeah, it is. That is a really like maybe the craziest story of the bunch.
It really is crazy. But then your letter was like a couple of years later, maybe 3 years later or something. You were about 15 when you wrote to me, I think.
Right.
So and you're a little older than Esther. So it was like 3 to 4 years later. And then that was like the floodgates breaking in a way, because it was three people, three kids, from two different, you know, moms or sets of moms, whatever. And so I was like, that's when I realized, oh, wow.
Right.
whoever wrote the letter to me, probably, I'm going to guess it was Deborah. I don't know. That they stuck in with your letter said, what did they say? We wanted her to wait till she was 18, but she's a strong-willed young lady, you know, something like that. And then I thought, oh yeah, 18. When they turn 18, maybe I'll start hearing from more kids. So it became a different thing for me by then, because the Esther thing was like, this is a real person,
right?
And there's a real, and you know, I was really attached to her, and you know, our families had connected and all that, and. It's like, wow, there's real people out there and they're almost grown up now. And so then I got really curious after you broke the floodgates.
Mm-hmm.
The joke that I, or the line that I always say about getting your letter, it was like certified mail or something. I had to go pick it up at the post office. Mm-hmm. I thought, uh-oh, I'm being sued.
Not quite.
No.
It's just me being like, can you pay for I want money like all these years. Donna, I mean, that was definitely Donna doing that, being like, I want to make sure he has to sign. You want to make sure that he gets the letter. And I was so surprised.
Yeah. No, that was
I got the email back.
Because so, that would be one, not one that you want to send out and wonder if it ever landed. You'd want to know. No, I thought that was
purposely ignored. Yeah. Or like,
And she was very nice. She said, I'm so-and-so, you know, I do this. My wife is so-and-so. And so I was like, okay. So I actually Googled them, made sure that, you know, just, you know, this was all on the level.
Uh-huh.
And like looked at their jobs and said, they're not after money for me, that's for sure. So yeah. I felt safe on that, you know, not that I'm not that suspicious of a person, you know, in general, but it was a really great letter to read. I'm sure I still have it. I didn't know how I filed it though.
Yeah, I forget because that's one thing that I don't actually have whatever I wrote to you.
It was handwritten.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's kind of like.
It was very sweet. It was like, maybe it was the last handwritten letter I've ever gotten. No, I think I probably have, but it was like, it was written in this like, you know, 15-year-old girl handwriting. It was great. It was totally, you know, I was taken by it.
That's wild that I handwrote it. That's funny. I didn't realize.
Yeah.
Because I have the email. I found the email, the first one that you sent.
Sent back.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So what was the question?
Oh, right. I don't even. About narcissism.
Oh, about narcissism. Right. I don't think I don't think I'm like abnormally narcissistic.
Yeah, I agree. Compared
to a lot of people that I know that I've worked with. No. But, you know, and it was, yeah, it was a lark, you know, I mean, it was sort of a lark and seemed like a good deed at the beginning. And then when you all became real people to me, then it just became like a mitzvah, you know, it was like, wow. Here's, right. And all the mothers, and it's mostly mothers that I've met or communicated with have been really great, interesting people, nice people, really, obviously really wanted to have children.
Right.
Or else they wouldn't have gone to that trouble. So they're really dedicated, you know, mothers. And, you know, it's just like a totally positive kind of thing.
Then I asked his thoughts on this theory that sperm donation is potentially connected to or similar to eugenics.
Yeah, I guess there's different degrees of design your child, right? Like the least design. Let's go back to the old-fashioned method, which is you meet somebody and you know, mate with them and create a child. That's a form of designing your child, right?
Right.
It's just that you can't isolate you can't isolate a lot of variables, right? You can't isolate the genetic material from the person's life. Mm-hmm. You know, you get the DNA and you get like an alcoholic. You know, I mean, you get somebody. You get their personality, you get their life. Do they make a lot of money? Do they not make money? Are they nice? Are they not nice?
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of that maybe has something to do with DNA, but mostly so that's like the least that you can do a la carte shopping, right?
Right. Yeah. Or like
now sperm donation is the next level, I suppose, of a la carte shopping where you can, there's a whole bunch of sort of profiles and you can say, well, I like this one I like this one a little less. So you can shop without getting the actual person that's the donor.
Right.
Now like going to, you know, the next level that we're into getting into now with designer babies and, you know,
gender and stuff.
Yeah. Picking for gender. And then going even further into science fiction land, which is not so far away, of like, you know, having the genes custom altered by, you know, CRISPR technology and all that kind of stuff.
That's crazy.
I think that's, you know what that is? CRISPR is like this technology that they can actually introduce these things into cells and change the DNA.
Oh.
This is like it's being used in labs everywhere for years now. So they're actually like starting to be able to go into organisms and like take out undesirable genes and stuff like that.
Oh, wow.
So of course, people who think about this stuff, ethicists are thinking like, well, when are they going to start doing that on humans, you know, or human zygotes, you know, human sperms and eggs. And so that's, I think people are freaked out about that jump to that level of a la carte baby making, you know, but I think that, so maybe some of your classmates are thinking along those lines when they bring up the idea of eugenics and like making the perfect race or the perfect baby or all of that kind of stuff.
They don't want any short men and like that type of
thing. Right.
Which is so funny.
Well, it is. It's donor shopping. I mean, or DNA shopping for sure. And the sperm banks, you know, they want DNA that they can sell.
Yeah.
You know, so it's funny. Yeah, that's funny. They don't take short men.
Yeah, is that they literally don't. Like,
yeah.
So yeah, so the application process and the screening, like, you did they like sit down with you, or was it more like you fill out some stuff?
Well, this was before everybody filled out all their forms on the internet anyway. Right. So to do something like this, you'd always do things like this in person. And it was an interview that was like, they asked me about my medical history, my family's medical history. I don't know if they gave me like a real physical exam. I don't remember. I don't, maybe they did. I can't really remember, you know.
But they definitely had to test your sperm for like.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there were four numbers that came they tested every dose that I donated. There's like sperm motility, quantity. There were like four different things, mm-hmm. and if your numbers fell below certain levels, they didn't pay you. and if they stayed below those levels, I guess you got thrown out of the program. You know, so I guess I passed, but so I'm trying to think if there were other things. And they asked you personal questions about, like, you know, what do you do, you know, your job, your, you know, what are you interested in, you know, just
so
profile
is that
stuff.
Separate? So something that I found when I basically was looking, and it's funny that your like number is still on the website, like you can't buy any of it obviously, but it's still there, right. So I called and was like, I'm the offspring of number, you know, whatever,
5182,
right? And I got so freaked out when I first was starting this, and that day that I looked at the thing, because I was like, those are the last four digits of my social security number, like I'm 100% positive. But it's
are
not
you serious?
It's not. Oh. it's close.
That I was gonna lose it on that one. That was, you know, the Esther thing. Okay, I get that, but that was gonna be too weird. So,
but they sent me the whole like file, which I had already had. But they sent me an MP3, a digital version of this audio tape.
Mm-hmm.
That I don't know if that's what you're referencing, like when they interviewed you and asked you some kind of weird questions, like about your personality. Is that a thing?
No, the only thing that they taped was a voice sample. They said, because they can't show a picture of the person,
right.
It's too identifiable.
Mm-hmm.
But they said, are you willing to give a voice sample? I said, sure. So I read, you know, but then maybe they had a script, or maybe they just said, say something or whatever. Mm-hmm. So that might be the audio tape.
But I've never heard that, but they sent me this video, this audio file, and I listened to it. It's 15 minutes. It's you talking. It's you answering questions.
Really?
Yeah, it's the weirdest.
Oh, they kept that? I had no idea that they kept that.
Yeah, they kept. Yeah.
Do you still have it?
Yeah, I can send it to you when this is done. It's so funny.
Oh, I'd love to hear that. That's so out.
It's from 1998.
Where would you like to go that you haven't been before?
The ladies' room. I'm just kidding.
Which made me laugh.
Semper wise guy.
Okay, so then we started talking about at-home genetic testing kits and how they kind of eliminate the possibility of anonymous donation, because you can get all this information about distant relatives now. He did one of these tests, 23andMe, a few years ago, and I was curious about that.
It was a friend of mine gave it to me as a Christmas present or a Hanukkah present. And I didn't really, to be honest, I didn't think through, you know, this was certainly after Esther and probably after you had contacted me, but I still just, it didn't put it together in my mind, like, there could be my children on there, because I didn't I wasn't that interested in. So I hadn't investigated and thought about the different things that.
Right. The fact that they like save all this data in like a thing, and and you can see like who related to. Yeah, that's like.
That's right. But you do have the choice to show your data or not.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. With 23andMe, it's like, well, if you want to make your data available to other people who have taken the test, and we can tell you if you're related, then you can, but you don't have to. And I thought, once I'd gotten that far, I was like, well, what the hell?
Yeah.
here we are. And then Ruby turned up first, who I still haven't met. I've emailed with her, but I've never met her.
Okay, so did you tell your family about your decision to donate? If yes, how did they react? And if no, why not? I guess I mean at the time.
At the time, I told my wife.
You
although
did.
I didn't ask her before I did it. I didn't get her permission. I just did it. And
was she mad?
He was a little distressed, but our marriage was kind of like we were kind of pulling apart. And probably the fact that I would do that without telling her was probably
a part of
it. Was probably a little problematic, but yeah. We'll take it as an indication of the fact that we were like moving apart from each other.
Mm-hmm. But you didn't tell anybody.
I don't think I told my family until Esther appeared.
Right, because you had
and to then I had to explain the whole thing. Yeah.
How did they react?
They all were totally delighted, delight. I remember when Esther's mother contacted me, and I went, you know, communicated with her for not very long, for maybe a week. Like, we sent a few emails, we talked on the phone, and we decided, well, what the heck, let's meet and, you know, Because we were so connected on so many other weird coincidental ways, mm-hmm. that it was just like, okay, this is like a person that I could be friends with.
Right.
So I picked up Luca, and, you know, we're driving, and I said, I have to tell you something. And I said, so many years ago, I was a sperm donor. And he like thought about it for a second. He said, do I have a sibling?
That's funny.
He figured it out like before I could even get the second half of anything out, before I could tell him. And he always wanted to have a sibling, you know, when he was a little kid. He felt lonely, you know, or whatever, just wanted to have a sibling. And so I said, well, yeah, you do. And I found out about her, and I think we're going to go meet her. And we looked at each other, and he was however old he was, 14. And I said, I said, are you nervous? And he said, yeah. And he said, are you nervous? And I said, yeah. It was like a little special sharing moment for dad and lad. We were both a little nervous. And we went to the door and bang, bang, bang. And sort of, you know, door opens. There's the three of them, grandpa. And it was just, it was surreal for sure. But I mean, we had a similarly surreal moment, you know, in a way, although it was just with me and you and your mom's. But it's a strange.
Oh, when
thing
you when I first
when,
met you
when yeah when
oh
when
like exactly in person when, yeah yeah
in person, and so we kind of like stiffly all kind of walked into the living room and sat down, and I was sitting next to Esther and looking at her, and she was looking at me, and I said, kind of like looking in the mirror, right? And she said, yeah, and then so we started talking a little bit, and then Luca and Esther ran off to go, you know, play, do something.
That's so funny.
And the two of them, they're 4 years apart, but they clicked right away. And then the other worrisome relationship was my grandfather, who was a little skeptical about meeting the donor and all this. And he was a little skeptical. But then it turns out he's like a real music lover, a jazz head from way back. And, that's you know, funny. And so we got talking about, you know, Billie Holiday and Duke Ellington and all this old jazz. And within a couple of minutes, he was like, you know,
approving.
He was approving. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe like picked you on a certain level because of the similarities or something between.
Yeah. 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 She's a music person too. So yeah. So there's music in the band. But I think you're onto something there in terms of, I mean, this is like getting into, you know, a whole other level of psychology, but but I always think that, you know, people, there's the whole Freudian thing about,
yes,
you know, and sometimes, you know, somebody's sibling and their opposite sex parent will be really similar, or they'll look alike or something, and you go, did this guy marry mom, you know, or did she marry dad, or, you know, there's, I mean, and it's way too simplistic to, but there, it's an interesting way to sort of try to line things up. Like, you know, did pick someone who she thought her dad was like her dad, or she thought her dad would approve of,
or like subconsciously, like it felt sort of familiar or something because of. And I think that it's especially when you're looking at, you have no concept of like who this person really is. So it's sort of a perfect opportunity to project what you want to see onto these profiles. Like my parents, like part of their reasoning, I think, was because like on paper or something, you reminded them of Donna, which is such a, so it was sort of like a way to get both of them in there. But then now knowing you, there's nothing, like, I totally don't see that. And I don't think that you're alike at all.
I mean, I think maybe sense of humor, but you know.
It's very, so it's funny, but
New York sense of humor, yeah.
Right, but the projection of like, you see what you kind of want to see, like.
That's true.
Or you come up with sort of a reasoning that like makes sense to you.
We got pretty sidetracked, but then we got back to talking about his family's reactions.
Like, okay, my dad, he's going to be kind of a curmudgeon because, you know, it's just sort of dad's job to be a curmudgeon, or some dads anyway. So we got up there, we're at dinner with my dad and my stepmom, and Luca's kicking me in the leg under the table. He was like so excited. He was like, and so I told my dad, and he was like immediately totally, you know, excited about it. He thought it was great. He thought it was a great story. And being the person that he was, he immediately said, and she can write her college application essay about it.
That's something Donna would say.
That's like. And in the end, she did.
Oh, really?
I mean, it was framed as the her search for identity.
Yeah, yeah.
Or something like that, you know. So
I think I definitely threw in like, I have gay moms, like give me points.
Yeah, right. I'm
like,
yeah, right. Exactly.
You know, but it wasn't about that. But yeah, that's that was definitely referenced in both and even in mine, I'm pretty sure.
Right, I have gay moms and they had to raise extra money to buy me the prosthetic foot that I need after I stepped on a landmine. No.
A landmine.
So I told my dad, he was very excited. And then my brother and his wife and their two twins who are the same age as Luca, a couple, a little bit younger, were coming up the next day to visit. And so the next night, this is like the same scene again. We're sitting at the dinner table and now Luca's kicking one of my legs and my dad's kicking the other leg. And I told them and they were totally excited too. And they were just excited about more cousins, more cousins.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know how else you would like how one, like what the alternative, because it's not like, you know, you can take it back or something. Like it's sort of like, purpose in getting super angry because it's like, this is a 12-year-old child who already exists. So
I guess, you know, if you were like paranoid about people's intentions, you might, you know, and you didn't understand the amount of legal protection you have,
right?
You know, but you know what I learned about all of this from, you know, from Esther turning up is that you all are obviously real people, and you have lives, and we're connected, but taking, you know, new family members, you know, connecting with new people and new family members is. It can mean a lot of different things, you know, and so like I suppose some people could be like, oh, do I really want to have a new relative, new sort of relative that I'm going to feel connected to, or maybe responsible for, or will I feel responsible for them, or what is it going to be? It's like a whole new sort of negotiation, like trying to figure out what it is. But my family just seems to be like completely like. Yeah, man, the more the merrier, you know. Mm-hmm. They've been really, you know, quite positive about all of it.
So they know about the whole like lot of people?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if they know the current count, but
I don't think I do. Yeah.
Yeah, right. They certainly know about, you know, Esther and you three and probably a little more than that, I think. I don't think I've given them the sort of like total rundown, or not all of them. Maybe, you know, I've had different conversations with different people.
Right, and you can't.
You know, it's not like dinner table conversation. I just want to give you the current rundown on how many Children. Donor children I know about, and here's their names, and I'm going to quiz you on their names at the end of this meeting. You know, they're all, you know, they all sort of have different perceptions of the whole thing, but they're all, you know, they're all very open to it all.
Does your mom know about it?
That's a good question. Well, she knows Esther, so yeah. So of course she does. Yeah. I don't think she's definitely not apprised to the a current count, but she's a little bit out in its space, and she's sort of deaf. And when she doesn't want to understand something, she says I can't hear. She's sort of half deaf, there's a lot of information that she doesn't get. You know, I had another thought a minute ago about families and sizes of families. I can't remember. Maybe it's just because I'm one of four siblings, and you know,
right?
And we have big families, so it seems like okay, you know,
right?
More people, lots of cousins, and all that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't have a lot of experience with that at all, because based on the genetic level, like I didn't know about any of you guys until I was however old. And then Deborah's siblings, she has a brother who's not married and doesn't have kids, and then her sister has one child who is 10 years younger than me, so that's the only cousin. Wow. And then Donna's brother has two sons, but they're like 35 and 40,
right? So they're
like,
way...
no, you know, it was never like cousin close in age.
This is your like cohort, is your half siblings.
Right. Yeah.
You know? Yeah. It's a funny thing that, especially now that, you know, for me, now that I'm the advanced age that I am, the connection that you feel with your cousins is really interesting. Even though we didn't grow up like in the same town or anything like that, we would just see each other, you know, a handful of times a year. Just the fact that they're your cousins or you're related and you've known each other for your whole lives, or, you know, I'm older than some and younger than some, is really becomes more profound, like as you get older.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's nice that you guys will have, you know, have at least met as around 20 year olds, you know, and that'll be something that, you know, to the extent that you all want to pursue it, you know, those relationships will probably mean more as time goes by, because it gives you like a reason to track somebody and stay in touch with them that has nothing to do with your job or your, you know, just other stuff. It's just like you're connected, like biochemically, mm-hmm. you know, sort of cosmically.
Yeah.
And so that's a reason to stay in touch that will become more meaningful, I think, if my own experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it kind of is like cousins. I hadn't thought about it.
Yeah.
So I get into this a lot more in future episodes, but sperm donation clinics basically have no real regulations. For a long time, the process was extremely unmonitored, and it created a whole host of ethical problems, including donors having hundreds of children. By the time my siblings and I were conceived in the late 90s, things had improved some, but these clinics were still pretty much a shit show. I asked my donor what he thinks about this.
Donors don't know the number of children they have because you don't have to report a birth. It's suggested, but it's not required. So offspring don't know how many siblings they might have because of that same reason, because the sperm bank doesn't even know.
Right.
You know?
Right.
There's a lot of,
I think there are a lot of ethical problem areas in there. I mean, the most sort of obvious one is like the thing about, you know, whether, you know, having a child with your half sibling who you don't know your half sibling.
Yes, that's totally something that people always bring up to me, or like
that's the most obvious one. But I guess there's more ethical implications about, like, you know, one person having so many offspring, you know.
Right, and they don't know about it, and how would that?
They don't know about it. How does that affect the, you know, does it affect? I mean, how does it affect society?
And some people that are donor conceived might not even know, because,
right,
you know, it's like their dad was having issues, so they used a donor and never told a kid.
Right. I think so, that was I think that was Rachel's story. And statistically, you know, it's hard to sort of know, like, what are the odds of any of these things happening. But on the other hand, as our very case shows us, people sort of run in social circles. And so you're more likely to run into certain kinds of people than other kinds of people.
Right.
You know, so this the statistical likelihood of donated donated sperm running into each other socially, mm-hmm. it's not as astronomical as one might think.
But I think we've talked about, but did you have a the idea of having a number or a max number in mind of how many donor kids you wanted or you thought that would happen? So you said you didn't have any kind
of. No, I didn't really game it out like that.
Right.
You know, I had no idea how they apportioned the sperm, whether mm-hmm. it was like a one-to-one sort of donation to dose or if they, I never really investigated it. I wasn't that and I'm usually interested. It's funny because I'm usually interested in technical information of all kinds, how things work. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, I never went down that rabbit hole.
Right.
You know,
sperm
donation mechanics. Like I never even, I don't think I've even really asked any of the donor moms. Laura is one I've spent the most time with, like, how much did it cost? Like how did just what were the mechanics of the whole thing? Mm-hmm. And which is odd for me because I like to know that about almost everything in the world.
Right, but maybe it hits a little too, like it's
Maybe there's some subconscious block that I have to it.
It's like, I don't want to know about, pay per vial, I think.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's what I think I heard that. Yeah, you pay per vial. But like, I'm not sure if that vial is created by one donation or...
Right.
Or if that vial is 1/10 of one donation, you know, all of that stuff. So
right. Do they take all of the stuff you supply and put it in a bucket and you divide?
Right, exactly.
I don't know. It's like horrible.
We've done a good job of not getting too, too icky here, but you know.
This is a clarifying question. When you stopped making the donations, like after the Aiden thing.
Mm-hmm.
Did they tell you that all of the vials or all of your, like, did they tell you that all of the vials had been bought up and they told you that the profile would no longer be shown to people?
Nope, zero information. Literally, okay. Like the day that I walked out when they said, you're too old, they didn't say your sperm's no good. They just said, it's our policy, you're, mm-hmm. you're
but
too
then
old.
After you went back because went of back. The Aiden situation, like yeah.
After that, no, because I said to them, can you get a picture of this girl, Kaylee, who I'm going to meet in like 15 years.
Yeah.
And they never responded. You know, apparently they didn't ask your parents.
Right.
They were just a black box. It just, you know.
And you were under the impression that you were donating this, like, extra stuff just to this one family.
Yes.
Right.
They said we have a client that wants to have another child from the same donor. They didn't put in the second half of this sentence, which is like, and we'll sell the rest of this to whoever shows up.
Right.
You know,
so did you think that would happen?
I didn't. I thought the way they put it to me, it sounded like this is going to one place.
So when I was at this point, we had already known Isabel. So I was probably like 10 or 11. My parents, they told us about this woman that reached out who is a sibling, like through the donor sibling registry. And she had a child who at the time was like 3 years old. So there's a girl
who is
much younger than Aiden.
Really?
Maybe she's like 13 or 14 or something.
Oh, it's a girl.
Yeah. The weirdest gender reveal ever.
Okay, pause. Let me explain this whole half-sister situation a little further. My father only donated sperm for about a year. In late 2001, my mom's attempted to buy more of his particular sperm to give me a full sibling, but his ID number showed up as unavailable. They contacted the bank to reach out to him, and he re-entered the program, thinking it would only go to my parents, who he obviously didn't know at the time. But it seems that the clinic kept some of this redonation without anyone's knowledge or consent and continued to sell it. That's why there was a girl born in 2008. That could mean that there are more half-siblings out there, but we'll never know for sure. I get into this particular situation more in a later episode.
I don't know. For whatever.
Maybe she just wants to wait, or, you know.
Yeah. So you're not going to. I don't even know their last name. So I don't even know how to. So I can't, like, you know, you're not stalking these people. But
no, I'm okay.
Yeah, I know. But that's a weird. And that has been. That's like perplexed me ever since I sort of put two and two together of like, well, if she was born like so many years after.
Right.
It's like, is there this whole other group of people that are like born between Aiden and her?
Right. Did they have more saved up than whatever?
Than they sort of said to my parents and said to you or didn't say. It's like so weird. Yeah.
That's so interesting. That's another little chapter.
I know.
So that's 10 that I know. 11 then, plus Luca.
So it's,
you know,
12.
Plus old Luca. You know.
Yeah. Boring. Yeah.
You know, there was sex. I had sex with his mother, and then we had a kid. You know, it was like, well, that's interesting. Okay.
But don't tell anyone you know, because I wasn't
okay.
supposed to.
No, and I have to say, I'm totally impressed that you, Aiden, Isabel, and your three moms have been totally, that's some real good James Bond shit that you, mm-hmm. you know. It's all very personal, you know. It's
and there was a time when I felt like this weird gatekeeper of information, because it was like this person, like I had to be like, this person knows about this, but then that person doesn't know about this,
right,
like, you know. But yeah,
no, I'd say a total open, I think, you know, it should be just open door policy. It's just too complicated to keep track of that stuff.
Yeah,
or open information.
Yeah, yeah. Open door. I'm like, hello.
maybe not open door, you know.
So, why did I only tell my donor this information now? After I discovered his identity, my moms told me that this sister's mother was not interested in getting involved, so my parents asked me to keep her a secret. And I did, for 7 years. But now that my half-siblings and our donor are much closer, I felt like I was lying by omission. I don't know if this half-sister realizes that she's donor-conceived or not, but all of us would love to include her if she ever reached out. Anyway, back to the conversation.
I have a feeling I sort of know the answer, but it's still sort of an interesting idea of, do you feel the same way about your donor children as you do about the son you raised? Or like, how do you conceptualize? I mean, obviously no, but like,
no.
How?
Oh gosh, it's I would say what we were talking about before, about feeling like maybe they're sort of like cousins. I sort of feel a little bit like avuncular, you know, uncle like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, I'm glad you knew that word. You know, because I feel attached. We're genetically related.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm somebody, like I'm trying to keep a little eye over at least those of you that I've known and have. That I feel like I've been a sounding board about some things for some of the moms. But I feel, you know, but like towards nieces and nephews, like I really care about like all of your well-being, and, you know, mm-hmm. I try to be, and I'd be happy to be helpful in any ways that I can, and look forward to developing, you know, relationships with anyone mm-hmm. of the bunch that wants to get to know me more. And, you know, I'm not trying to push it with everybody because I don't want to, I just my policy is like I'm open to getting to know, you know, my donor children, but I don't want it to be like there's this creepy old man who's like, you know, wants to, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I sort of respond in kind. Like if somebody writes me a nice note, I try to like come back on like, you know, with this similar level, like, you know, that level sounds funny, but, you know, I just try to meet people where they are.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. It does totally tickle me that you all are developing your connections with each other. I think that's really amazing. And, you know, I'm I'm glad you're doing it. And you have been sort of a ringleader in this, so thank you for doing that. But I'm glad you're no longer the gatekeeper.
Yeah.
Oh, I think it's great. And it's funny because everybody has found me a different way. You're the only detective in the bunch.
Mm-hmm.
You're the only one that actually said, okay, I've got this data and I'm going to figure this out.
Mm-hmm.
Esther was pure coincidence.
Right.
Ruby was 23andMe, and the three boys were 23andMe. They have a hyphenated last name that I can't remember either one right now.
That's right. Damn Jewish hyphenated lesbian. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. There's swarms of them. The place is lousy with them.
It's like, you get an award. You are a true ally to the
game. I guess I'm Jewish lesbian bait.
Yeah.
On paper. Only on paper.
Yeah, obviously.
So, and then Rachel was the only one who went through channels. Like she came through the sperm bank. She wrote the sperm bank and said, "I'm a donor child of your sperm bank, and I would like to get in touch with the donor." And so they called me up one day, and they said they were being very delicate. They were like, "Yes, this is so and so from California Cryobank.
Uh-huh.
A child that was conceived with your donated sperm is interested in getting in touch with you. You're not obligated to do this."
Yeah, yeah. And you don't have to do it.
It was like this whole thing, and I just started laughing. I was like,
"Yeah, the one rule follower.
Join the party."
Yeah, the only one to wait. The
only one.
Time.
I said, "Yeah." I said, "I'm fine. I'm totally open to it." And then she didn't. She took another at least 6 months, if not a year, before she actually reached out to me.
When I found out, I was like, I'm writing a message to all of these people. I was very impatient or something. I think Donna actually made me wait. She was like, "Aiden's bar mitzvah is in a few weeks, and I don't want this clouding the whole thing. I swear to God."
That is
so
too
she
classic.
She made me wait a month or something. Which is so funny.
Right. That is so funny.
I'm not overshadowed.
The humor, the stories in this whole thing are just too hilarious.
But I don't know what compelled me that weekend or why maybe we found the files and I was like, I feel like I could probably
figure this
Google
one out.
I got so Mom, come in here.
this is well, and people, when I've told people the story, they're like, whoa. And of course, I say anybody could find out. And I say, well, when I made the donation, it was before Google, it was before internet search. Back in 1998, if you wanted to track down somebody from even the information in the donor file,
yeah, that would have been
you'd have to travel, or hire a private investigator,
uh-huh,
or you'd have to go to a lot of trouble.
A library of some sort.
Yeah, a library. Once Google was invented, it's a 20-minute process for somebody.
Yeah, no, I think it actually took somewhere around 20 minutes of sort of making.
We ended up talking some more, but it was getting late, so we had to wrap it up.
Okay, it's really been great. This has been super fun. I hope you can turn it into a good project. And,
yeah, I think I will.
Get an A+.
Yeah.
Get an A++. I'll talk to you soon.
Yeah. Okay. Bye.
Okay. Bye.
All right. That's all for this episode of Message in a Bottle. Of course, special thanks to my genetic father for donating sperm 24 years ago and for talking with me about it now. And thank you all for listening. If you want to know more about donor conception, I put some links to other podcasts and articles in the episode description. Okay, bye!